We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Audacy put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Audacy. Visit ads.audacy.com.
Mully and Hall, mornings live at 5 on Sports Radio 670 The Score. 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
Talking to John, I saw the passion, you know, that he had for, you know, for the Bulls and for city of Chicago. He's is going to be a great resource for me. He's too, excited for a new direction, which makes my job easier.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. That is the voice of the chief decision maker, as we're calling him. He is our tourist. Carter Chauvis, had a chance to talk to him yesterday. Very impressive guy. And we are delighted to welcome in the president and chief operating officer of the Chicago Bulls. Michael Reinsdorf joins us on the Al Pamani Ford hotline. Al Pamani Ford in Melrose Park. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. I'm doing well. A little tired, but I'm doing well. I don't know how you guys do this every morning, though.
Well, we get up and we get going. You give us a lot to talk about this week. A lot of content, and it's been a lot of news, Michael. And I think that you guys were in a very unusual situation, as we all are, and we find ourselves facing. And as an organization, I found it, I don't want to say most fascinating, but you decided to take advantage of this downtime and this respite in sports and with the NBA season. I guess maybe we can start there. What went into that decision to maybe use this time as you did productively to create and to make such dramatic change in the organization?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's just a horrible, horrific situation that we're in, and our hearts go out to all those who, you know, obviously are suffering from this awful virus, who have lost loved ones, who are out of work. It's bad for everyone. At the same time, you know, we're all working from home, sheltering at home, and I just felt that we got to figure out how to make some lemonade out of the lemons, as far as the situation of not being in the office and not being able to play basketball. And I just felt if we made a move now to make the change, that would give the new head of basketball operations an opportunity to really get to know his staff and get to know the other assistant general managers, the analytics people, the coaching staff, the medical staff. And if you waited until, you know, a typical time, which is April, you know, right after the season, then you got to go through a process of interviewing people. And then if you do it quickly, let's say it takes a couple weeks, then you're looking into May, and then that person has to hit the ground, you know, running. They got to do all their hiring. They got to hire the general manager, the assistant, you know, the additional assistant general manager, the different additional staff that I knew we were going to have to be adding to this organization. And I just felt this gave us a great opportunity, gave this person a great opportunity to take his time and really get to know everyone.
Well, he really seems like a quality hire. And, it's interesting to see you go outside the organization. And just in talking to people, you had success doing that on the business end. Did that inform your decision to do it on the basketball end?
I mean, I don't, for me, I'm comfortable. I was very comfortable going outside the organization. It really, you know, you're right. The success we've had on the business side of going outside the organization is great. I think for a lot of years, the Bulls on the business side, new positions would open up and people would just transfer from one department to another. And I'm not saying that always happened, but that happened a lot. And for me, I'd rather go outside the organization and get the expertise. And also, you learn a lot, whether it's in other businesses, whether it's from other teams. The person that runs our who's now basically our chief revenue officer. He came, started with me as our director of analytics, and then, you know, quickly grew into a vice president role in strategy analytics, and then kind of took over our sponsorship side, and now he's taking over the ticketing side. So there's so many smart people out there, and they can add so much value to our organization. And you don't, in the business side, you don't necessarily have to be an expert in basketball to work for the Bulls. On the basketball side, you better be, though.
Michael, I know you do your best to insulate yourself from some of the outside criticism and external factors and pressure. And at the same time, you are responsive enough that you've been known to call season ticket holders after tough seasons to kind of empathize with what they're going through and what they're seeing. How much did the fan either anger or maybe even apathy when they stopped going to games with as much frequency as they used to go to games or traditionally go to games, how much did that compel you to make a move now?
I certainly don't want to say that what the fans were saying or what our season ticket holders, the people that I was reaching out to, were saying didn't have any effect on me. But it's not the reason why you make changes like this. Because nobody really knows what's going on inside the organization. So people out there may think we made a change because of, you know, we were unhappy with a draft choice that we made or something like that. You know, the things that you can see. For me, it was more about I really was listening to John and looking at the organization and thinking about our process and what was going to happen going forward. And to me, it just seemed like now was definitely the right time to you know, make these changes.
I find it fascinating that you listen to John. And one of the things, you know, that John has the best interests of the franchise at heart. And he came to you and talked to you about the need for change and the need for updating and effectively, you know, his willingness to do what was right for the organization, if that were the requirement. Had John not come to you, would we not be in this spot? Would the status quo have remained?
No, I don't think so. It wasn't like it was just like all of a sudden it was like a drop dead date that boom, this conversation that we had. You know, John and I have been talking for a long time. I wasn't thrilled with where we were as a team, as an organization. And, you know, I shared that information with John, and then, you know, we continued to try to affect change and improve the organization. But at some point, John did have that heart-to-heart with me, and he just said, Mike, I'm not the right person to lead this organization for the next 10 to, you know, 15 years. And I think it's really important that you have the right person working with you. And so that really was kind of like the kickstart to it. That was where, you know, okay, all right, let's go. We have a decision, and now let's figure out how we're going to move forward.
So John Paxson's been part of this organization for over 30 years, Michael, and obviously that connection speaks for itself. You also had a very good relationship with Gar Forman, who came to the Bulls in 1998. So when you hire Arturas and you have these conversations, what kind of direction did you give him or counsel regarding the futures and what to do with John Paxson and how to handle his, you know, role as a senior advisor and what to do with Gar Forman? How did those conversations go?
Well, it was actually short conversations, because you can't hire a head of basketball operations and then have all these like restrictions on them. I mean, you can't say that we're the type of ownership that hires people and then on the basketball side and then steps aside and lets them make their, you know, make their decisions. So the conversation with AK was short. We actually asked him what did he want to do. And the thing about Arturas is that he came prepared, and he already knew all about John Paxson. He knew the kind of person that John is, and the fact that John bleeds Chicago Bulls. You know, he cares more. John's decision, and whether people, you know, liked him or didn't like the job that he did at the Bulls over the years, John's decision was about the Chicago Bulls and about the fan base, and it was about doing what's right for the organization. So a tourist had checked around the league and talked to a lot of different people and teams and, you know, really got an understanding of what John's about. And at the end of the day, when we started the interview, we made it very clear, this job is for head of basketball operations. We're not going to call you president of basketball operations because it's confusing because there's another president to the team, but you are the head of basketball operations. You're the vice president of basketball operations. And what you want to do going forward, you tell us.
And it sounds as if, Michael, that you're more than willing to expand. You're more than willing to do whatever it takes to allow him to do the job that you've hired him for. Are there no monetary restrictions? I mean, at some point, do you want to be careful about how much you do? It's there's not a lot of income coming in, but I mean, where are we at with
right.
that?
Right. There's definitely not only is there not a lot of income, there's no income coming in. So the organizations, basketball organizations have really, they've dramatically changed in the last five, six, maybe 4 or 5 years. So how a team was set up 10 years ago is different than how they're set up today. We've made small changes. We've hired sports performance coaches, nutritionists. We've added to, we've had an analytics person in there for a long time, but we've added in that department. But our scouting department wasn't very large. And I'm not looking to add, we're not looking to add 20 scouts. This is basketball. It's not baseball. But we told Arturis that we wanted him to build this organization out from a standpoint that he's comfortable with. So we never really talked about monetary restrictions, but he came from an organization in Denver that was very well organized, not a large organization themselves. So I think he has a belief that it's important that we add people. For me, what I'm more concerned with is, and one of the reasons I really is excited about our tourists is that add people, but add people that are really smart and really driven and really capable and surround yourself with the best people. And that's what I heard a lot from other people, is that a tourist is really good at bringing on incredible, smart people. And, he's already done that. He brought on J.J. Polk, who I had a 45-minute conversation yesterday just to say hello and learned a lot about his background and how impressive he is. And he then brought on Pat Conley, who is, I've already heard from different people in the media and other teams about how great of a scout that he is, and former assistant manager in Phoenix. So Arturis he's going to bring a brain trust. He's going to be surrounded by a lot of people. There are going to be a lot of people in the room helping him through the process to make the ultimate final decisions.
We're talking with Michael Reinsdorf, the president and chief operating officer of the Bulls here on The Score. And Michael, I know you prefer to keep a low profile. I know you're somewhat averse to controversy, and yet you wanted to speak out when the perception was building locally and nationally about the fact that the Bulls were not inclusive in their search for the next chief decision maker. It turns out your short list had six names on it, and two of them were minority candidates. How important was it for you to be inclusive in this search and then to step forward when the suggestion was that the Bulls weren't?
It's incredibly important. We're a big believer on with both teams that it's really important that teams have diverse cultures. And as I've said all along, being diverse is the right thing to do, but it's also the smart thing to do. If you want people from different backgrounds to have input in your organizations and different perspectives, then you have to hire these people. You can't have everyone all the same, right? Like if everyone is from is a white person from Highland Park, Illinois, you're going to be pretty one-sided as an organization as far as different perspectives. And so it was incredibly important to me. It was kind of unfortunate. I understand the criticism, and it's truly not something that we were trying to do to hurt anyone. We had a short list. Two of the people on the list were diverse candidates, and we were denied permission. So at that point, I could have added other people, But if they didn't, if they weren't part of the shortlist to start with, what would that say about me to go interview a diverse candidate who didn't realistically have any shot at the head of basketball operations? I thought that would be disingenuous to them, and just it would just be an unfair situation. I obviously, when it first came out, I pushed back, and I was not happy. I mean, I was disappointed, because I was more disappointed for my dad, because I look at everything that he's tried to accomplish in sports over the last 40 years, and obviously building championships and, you know, winning a World Series, those are always the goals. But he also had other goals, and that was to build diverse organizations. And in baseball, he was the first chairman of the diversity committee. And I believe that they instituted the Rooney Rule before the NFL did. They just never, you know, no one ever made a big deal out of it. But, you know, he had Kenny Williams as his head of baseball operations since, I don't know, 1999, 2000. And by the way, Kenny was part of my process early on. If we had done these interviews in person, I wanted Kenny to be part of it, because I wanted to get his perspective as someone who's led an organization, a sports organization. So for me, it was more about, you know, I really wanted to protect my dad. He deserved that. And I knew that we're an organization that's very diverse, and that we were going to become even more diverse on the basketball side. We just haven't done a lot of hiring over the last few years. And so the plan was always to be smart about this and add a lot of diversity to our organization on the basketball side.
I think a couple things really came out when we heard the news conference with you and AK on it. One of which was, you talked about that, and you talked about not wanting to hurt anybody, and that you had regret if anyone was hurt about it, and explained exactly what you just said. The other element was you had arranged for him to, I guess it was a Zoom, you guys were going to do your official interview, and then you called him the night before, and you texted, hey, do you mind if I give you a call? And you guys ended up on the phone for like 90 minutes. Like, we're all sitting around waiting to do stuff. And you just,
right.
You were just like, hey, I got to talk to this guy. What the heck am I doing here? I loved that. I just thought that was so human.
Well, you know, what happened was, I was talking to different people, actually talking to Masai over, the general manager of the Toronto Raptors. And we were just talking about the process. They had already said, I said to him, Masai, like, this is a little awkward. We, you know, not being able to do it in person. And he shared with me that, that's a really hard thing to do on Zoom. And, you know, he goes, when we hired Nick Nurse, you know, we spent a lot of time with him. And so, and it's interesting, Masai, you know, he's been, you know, he's one of the best general, you know, heads of basketball operations in basketball. And so I was just kind of listening to him and talk to him. And I realized afterwards, it's like, this can't be like a one-time Zoom interview. Like, this is our head of basketball operations. I have to figure out how to really get to know the person. The Zoom, I knew, was going to be, could be awkward. So I literally was in the car coming home. I had to drop something off at my dad's house. And before I pulled into my parking garage, I just decided to give a tourist a call. And so it was totally impromptu, and it was ended up being at least a 90-minute call. And it just relaxed me a lot, and it allowed me to then say, okay, tomorrow let's do, you know, we'll do the more formal interview where we have all the questions and all that stuff. But I needed to understand who he was as a person, and, you know, his comfort level with me, and, you know, vice versa. So it was interesting. But this is a great thing about when you talk to different people in the leagues, and everyone's willing to help and give advice, and whether it's talking to Masai or reaching out to someone in the media or talking to some of my friends who are owners of the teams, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about different candidates. I learned about people that I hadn't considered that I should add to the list. It was actually a really interesting, and it was a fun process. It was, I really enjoyed it.
Michael, before we let you go, I have to ask you about what your role is in kind of the conversations of when in the NBA might return, if it does return this year, and if there is a contingency plan that you support more than any other.
I'm just, at this point, I'm just a listener. We've had so many different meetings and calls, and no, there's no answers. And so I'm not sure what happens. I could offer up, okay, here's what I think. I think we're going to return to play in June, but I would be, if I did that, I wouldn't be being honest with you. I really don't know. The contingency plans, right now, I think the league is just trying to figure out how do they get back to play and what does that look like. And I don't, it's not going to happen, obviously, until we're safe and we're not going to put people in harm's way, and that's what's more important. Basketball is going to come back at some point. Sports will come back. When that happens, I really don't know, but it will be back.
Michael, thanks a ton for coming on. We love talking to you. I just got to run this by you. We got this Last Dance thing coming up, right? So we're going to get a chance to watch the front seat floor that some of us have to be around. And I keep telling these guys, I don't think this is going to be good for LeBron in terms of the GOAT conversation, because I think there's a generation of people that don't understand what Jordan was like, what his competitiveness was like. And I think the way the guy walked, everything he did, it's going to be fantastic.
It really is unbelievable. And LeBron is one of the greatest players of all time. There's no question. And to do some of the things that he's doing at 37 years old is incredible. But the pressure that Michael had to play under, and the duress of getting past Detroit, and the, you know, one thing that you'll realize when you're watching this is just how much we hated Detroit, and how much, like, beating Detroit was like that year in 91, we won two championships, right? Like, we beat Detroit, you know, we sweep them, and it was the best thing. And and then we beat the Lakers. But I think what's amazing is that the Bulls gave the right. At the time, they went to my dad and they asked, could we film? And my dad said, yeah, if you can get Phil's approval, then, yeah, you can be around the team. And then they obviously got Michael's approval, too. But what's fascinating is that they agreed with Michael that they wouldn't air any of this, show any of this footage until he said it was okay. And so now they've, you know, it's 20-something years later, and they've created this documentary. And it's, I got to believe that, based on when they release it, it's going to be one of the highest-rated documentaries of all time, and it's going to be a huge success for ESPN and Netflix. And I'm excited. I've seen a little bit of it. I've seen a little sneak preview of it, and I think it's going to be really enjoyable for people to watch.
Michael, thanks
great
so much
stuff,
for your time.
Michael, thank you.
Okay, great talking to you.
Take care.
All righty. That is Michael Reinstar. Fantastic stuff. I'm telling you, this is going to be something special, David. I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to it. And
good
and
stuff
I'm talking
from
about
him too.
The future of the Bulls. No, I'm just kidding. And their path. All right, it's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 6-7 of the Score.
For me, I'm comfortable. I was very comfortable going outside the organization. It really, you know, you're right. The success we've had on the business side of going outside the organization is great. I think for a lot of years, the Bulls on the business side, new positions would open up, and people would just transfer from one department to another. And I'm not saying that always happened, but that happened a lot. And for me, I'd rather go outside the organization and get the expertise. And also, you learn a lot.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 of the Score. Wow, a lot of fun to talk to Michael Reinsdorf about the process and how they got to AK. And, you know, just extraordinary to think about him dropping off something at his dad's house. He's sitting in the driveway. And they got the formal interview in the morning. You know what? I got to get to know this guy. Get on the horn with the guy. You're sitting there in your driveway. I got to tell you, I just love that image, and it really is, it's fantastic.
It is, Mully. I mean, that was a good conversation because I think Michael was very comfortable and he was very relatable. And I think everyone can imagine themselves doing the same thing, kind of being in the driveway, being at your parents and making a phone call, wanting to kind of, you know, break the ice with somebody you're getting to know and you at work and you want to get to know them a little better. And that is just what you heard. I think we also heard some things. Now, we could have talked to him for another 20 minutes, Mully, and the one thing we didn't ask him directly, but I think we got the answer to essentially in an indirect way, was about Jim Boylan. And I guess, and I'm curious of what you think about this as we kind of react to this. When we talked to him about how difficult it was to, you know, get rid of, move on from John Paxson and Gar Forman, two people who were, you know, close friends of his, allies for the past decade as boss, but he basically said you can't bring in somebody as a new head of basketball operations and tell them what to do or give them, you know, that those kind of parameters. Doesn't that apply to the head coach as well? Wouldn't you assume that, you know, if we ask Michael Reinsdorf?
Yeah, that's why I didn't ask that question, because I thought he answered it. I mean, he basically said that AK's calling the shots. And you don't hire someone and bring him in without giving him the ability to call the shots. And he gets to build up what he wants. You know, here's the thing, David, and we haven't really, we didn't talk to Arturis about it, and we didn't talk to Michael about it. But, you know, when you are getting a job like this, when you're going through a job interview, you know, so he's out in Denver, and he's got friends of his in the business, including his boss, that are giving him their version of what that interview has to be like. He's breaking down the roster. He has all the answers in place as to what he wants, what he needs, and how he would approach the job. This job interview is not something that he didn't prepare for, and it's not something that Michael didn't prepare for. And I think, again, you know, Michael wanting to get through the idea of getting to know someone before you start going through all the questions. We all know what the questions are. And one of those questions has to be about your thoughts on the coach and your thoughts on what has to be done with it.
You know what's good about that, with the way you just put it too, is that it emphasizes how important the human relationship, the human dynamic is in something like this, because you can look at the basketball credentials and you can get the recommendations from Daryl Morey or from Masai Ujiri or guys who have worked with AK in the past. And those, hey, great. He's a basketball junkie. He's an accomplished executive. But until you break down the kind of human dynamic and break the ice and have those conversations, that's what's going to really maybe make you feel more comfortable about your conviction. And I think that's what you heard in his voice, in his approach, and I think that's what makes you feel even better about this choice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he did his homework, I think, and he got the right guy. And I feel like 10 times better. I felt good about it when they hired him, but the last 2 days getting to talk to these guys, it gives you a little bit of insight into how, and this, again, is a more unique process than any other, because if he was coming to town, you'd be going out to dinner. You maybe have the wives meet each other. There's a ton of sort of socialization that goes on around the interview. And it, same thing in any kind of free agent situation. If you're bringing a guy in, part of it is getting to know the person and getting to relate. So I think that you're right. I think that there's the human element of just needing to connect. And that is ultimately the most important thing. There has to be a trust among the guy that hires you and the guy that gets the job.
And the commitment, as you pointed out, with no revenue coming in, the commitment to expand your front office and to modernize your approach speaks to just how committed the Bulls are to returning to winning and to getting back to being a contender. And this is the best news the organization has created in a long time. And it's been a long time coming. And I think he was also honest with being responsive to the fan apathy and anger. That was something that he did not want to say, you know, was the driving force necessarily, but it also was a contributing factor. So you can't ignore that. And I appreciated the fact that he was honest about it. He wasn't trying to be disingenuous in saying he had no role, because it did play a role in helping him kind of, or compelling him to make a move now.
All right, we're going to get back into some of this conversation, but we have a special segment that we're doing where we're breaking down different draft positions, and we have one of the great ones in this draft coming up next. It is the wide receiver position. I hope it is, David. I'd hate to think I was doing my research incorrectly.
It is.
But,
it is.
Okay, buddy.
Wide right. receiver.
We'll get to that next. It's Mully and Hawes, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Mully and Hawes, NFL Draft Breakdown. Wide receiver.
How bad is the Bears' need at wide receiver based on the roster?
I would say based on the offense, based on the roster, the need is high. High, high need. You need playmakers. This is an offense that doesn't score touchdowns. So forget for a minute that Taylor Gabriel is gone. You got rid of him for salary cap purposes, and you lost the speed guy. This is an offense that doesn't have playmakers, doesn't have playmaker guys. So I think you need a wide receiver. The wide receiver class is the hallmark of this draft. There's a wide receiver for every team. One of the fun things to look at when this draft is over is who didn't take a wide receiver. There are some unbelievable wide receivers. I saw Mel Kiper had his first round with six wide receivers going. The record for wide receivers in the opening round of a draft is seven. That was in 2004. I have a trivia question involving that from my research. I immediately looked up the 2004 wide receiver class. There were three of those wide receivers that year that wound up in the Pro Bowl. One was Larry Fitzgerald, the third overall pick. He's wound up in every Pro Bowl. I think he's made 11. The other one, former Bear, Roy Williams. And then the only other wide receiver out of that particular 2004 group.
Former Bear.
Well, he was for a year. Was the undrafted free agent, Wes Welker. Isn't that bizarre? So he was an undrafted free agent.
Oh, that's
and
bizarre.
And he made as many Pro Bowlers as that's Roy Williams bizarre. Or any other receiver taken in that draft. It tells you a little something. But this is a loaded group, and there's going to be a lot of fun with it. And the Bears need one.
I love your point that you continue to make about the wide receiver position, about how the Bears need guys who score touchdowns. And you know what? It's difficult, impossible even, to argue with that, but because everybody needs more touchdowns in their lives, especially if you have one of the five worst offenses in the NFL, which the Bears did last year. And frankly, Mully, when you look at their roster, Anthony Miller's lack of durability, if you want to call it that, is part of the reason you find yourself wanting a wide receiver as badly as the Bears do this draft. I think Allen Robinson, he's a number one bona fide, number one target, and his numbers speak for themselves. He is a consummate professional. That's not a problem. But everyone else in that receiving room is unproven, and I count Anthony Miller in there only because he has not been able to stay on the field long enough to carry through and to close the gap between potential and production. So I saw Kiper's six wide receivers going in the first round. I know this is a historically good, deep class, but if I am going to look at needs, I'm still looking at offensive line, and I'm ranking that ahead of wide receiver on my chart because that's just the way that I think, you know, it's about football philosophy sometimes, and I just think that the Bears' needs are more acute on the offensive line than they are in the wide receiver room. So I'm thinking that's one offensive line, 1A wide receiver.
But the question is, what are the Bears' needs? How would you rank it? Is it a high need, a low need, a non-need? And you're now, I guess I got to
It's a high need. It's a high need, not the highest of needs.
I got to find my offensive line list. Where's my offensive line list? I didn't know we were switching.
That's not today. No, that's not today. I'm just saying, and I'm trying to put it in context.
Wide receiver.
How badly will they reach... If they reach, how badly will they have to reach because of how bad of a need is it on your roster? And I just think that it's not as bad as it could be.
Who are the two or three possible players at the wide receiver position who might tempt the Bears either in the second round or later?
Well, Molly, you like your Mel Kiper because he's your guy. So he mentioned KJ Hamler. And there's a lot to like about KJ Hamler. If the Bears are in the second round and he's there, he's a smaller guy. He's a speedster, Penn State guy. Journalism major. How about that? So he's probably in that range of guys that would be available, depending on who drops. Michael Pittman, the USC kid, who I think has a good pedigree, has, you know, that we talk about clean picks. He comes from a big program. He's proven himself. But I really like, and I know this will come as no surprise because we've talked about him, Dustin will love this one, and you even mentioned him as a tight end possibility. But I think Chase Claypool gives you the speed dimension and the big body outside receiver that if he is there, and he could be there at the end of the second round, he would be very tempting and the kind of guy that the Bears would take a long, long look at.
Yeah, I have Chase Claypool as the top guy that would be available there. I think that with his height, with his speed, that combination, I mentioned him as a sub-package tight end because I'm trying to fight you guys off. You want to take a tight end at that spot, and I'm trying to give you a domer that I like that could do some tight end work in a sub-package. I mean, I get it. He's not going to be as good a blocker as Cole Kmet, but do they block with the Bears? Is that something they do? Do they use a blocking tight end? They've got tons of tight ends. That's for another day, but I'm with you. I got Chase Claypool. I got Jalen Reagor should be there, and that's an explosive playmaker. That's a guy that if you watch him play, he makes plays. Now, he'll drop some passes, and, you know, receivers will drop passes, but he will blow something up for you. I mean, he is an explosive playmaker, can make a big play. And then I included KJ Hamler, too, because supposedly he's a speedster. He claims to have run a 4.2 40, although you got to kind of wait and see on that one because he pulled a hammy and couldn't run and didn't have a pro day. So the numbers must be good. He must be a pretty fast guy to be on Mel's board, your guy, Mel.
Is there a possible sleeper player that might pique the Bears' curiosity?
Yes. I think there's a really good sleeper in this draft. Listen, there's going to be throughout this draft, there's going to be great players throughout this draft. But I saw early on, Peter King wrote a thing where he went up to Gil Brandt's room, and Dustin can talk about Gil Brandt as well as anyone because we used to have him on all the time at the other station years ago. And Gil is the guy that runs the combine. I know he's 87 now, but this was like his 45th combine or something. He just does a ton of work with it. He said he's got three sleepers in this draft. Derrick Brown, the defensive tackle, who's projected to go like seventh in the draft. Jonathan Taylor, the running back from Wisconsin, who is just, you know, has world-class track speed. And his third guy is my sleeper, Isaiah Coulter from Rhode Island. Brandt says that he's got a chance to be the DK Metcalf of this draft. He's 6'2". He ran a 4.45 at the combine, and Gil thinks he can get under 4.4, and he thinks he's got a chip on his shoulder because he's from Rhode Island. So go ahead and grab him late. Woohoo!
No, yeah, chip on his shoulder because he's from Rhode Island? Why would you do that?
Well, small school. Small school.
The smallest state, the smallest school.
No, he's not from Rhode Island. He went to Rhode Island. It's like a guy that played football at Ball State. They just have a chip on their shoulder.
Okay, yeah, I get that. I was waiting for that shot. So I love the sleeper question because it forces you to dig a little bit deeper. I think that when you talk about a sleeper, somebody in the fifth or sixth round, the Bears could look at their chart, their board, and say, we haven't got a wide receiver yet. We haven't got somebody to take the top off of defense. And boy, look at Jeff Thomas. Look at that Miami wide receiver who is a blazer and had pretty good numbers last year, modest numbers, but I think that he's coming from a big program. He's coming from, you know, an offense that he had 31 receptions, 379 yards, 3 touchdowns. Big play guy, maybe overlooked, but still offers you that speed element that you lack at the position. He's from East St. Louis. He was going to transfer at one point to Illinois. Now he can come to Chicago. Now he can be a Chicago Bear. So that's one sleeper. And the other one is just for the sake of pandering to Dustin, certainly. Chris Fink is your prototypical slot receiver. He is from Notre Dame. He is your Julian Edelman clone. He is a guy that if you are in the sixth or seventh round or maybe an undrafted free agent, maybe Chris Finke is the guy that you want to add to your organization.
Who is the Bears' best draft pick ever at the wide receiver position, factoring in draft position and career production?
That's a tough one. That's a tough one, Molly. I mean, the best draft pick ever. Now, I think when you factor in where a player was taken and what they got out of that player once they took that player, I'm going to go with Marty Booker, who was a fifth-round pick, a guy that you just didn't really – oh, I'm sorry, third-round pick, 78th overall, low expectations. He had a 100-catch season in 2001, 329 career catches with the Bears, 25 touchdowns, 3,895 yards. Marty Booker was Mr. Reliable, didn't play on a lot of great teams with the Bears, ended up in the big trade getting Adewale Ogunleye to Chicago. But I think Marty Booker, to me, is a guy, when you're looking for production, stands out.
I like that pick, David, and I certainly like Marty. Great dude and a guy that he looked like a big running back, right? I mean, if you know, he was a wide receiver, but he had this body where he could, once he got the ball in his hands, he was tricky. But I got to dig deep here, and I got to go with a guy named Harlan Hill. And you'll remember him, David, of course, drafted in the 15th round in 1954. just to put that in perspective, the draft is seven rounds long. So, and I listen, there were fewer teams then, so I don't want to make this sound like something ridiculous, but please don't interrupt a good story. Harlan Hill was taken in the 15th round. That means you could run two drafts and he'd still be an undrafted free agent these days. That's not true. Anyway, 15th round in 1954, as a rookie, 1,124 yards, 12 touchdowns. He averaged, wait for it, 25 yards a catch. 25 yards a catch. Like, it was in the 50s, so let's not get too carried away, but that's pretty damn impressive, and I got to go with Harlan Hill.
It's a good one.
No love for my guy Alshon, huh? Who is the biggest wide receiver bust?
All right. I want to go with Father of the Year, David Terrell, okay? And that's but I am going to instead say, unfortunately, Kevin White. And I say unfortunate because when a guy is a bust due to injury, I don't know what to say about it. But unfortunately, the guy was the seventh pick in the 2015 draft. He was the first draft pick of the Ryan Pace era, and we should have braced ourselves at that point. He wound up with 25 catches and no touchdowns. He suffered a stress fracture in his shin. He missed his rookie year. He came back. He played four games and broke his leg, the other leg. And then he came back and the first game of the year he broke his shoulder. And it's just, you know, a very nice guy. Unfortunately, we'll never know if he can play or not. He is out of football already, and just there's no way around it. 25 catches, no touchdowns, really no career with the seventh pick in a draft is rough.
I think it was just a gratuitous shot that you brought up David Terrell. There was no reason to bring up David Terrell. And you wanted to just take another shot because that's what you developed a habit of doing when David Terrell was in the Chicago Bears uniform. But anyway, I digress. David Terrell is a good one, but you know what? Kevin White retired the trophy. He not only is the biggest bust at wide receiver, he's one of the biggest busts the Bears have ever drafted at any position. So this was an easy one. I think we both agree why you articulated the reasons, and there was just – he set back a lot of things with the Bears and a lot of disappointments and created a lot of the skepticism that remains about Ryan Pace. But Kevin White, hands down, biggest wide receiver bust in Bears draft history.
I was saying to Kevin before we started that I really like this segment. This is a fun draft breakdown. And his response was, yeah, because there's so many big busts at every – like that's his favorite category, the biggest Bears bust. Sadly, Kevin White was very recent.
I used a little bit more flowery language there, Molly. Thank you for cleaning that up.
Well, we are subject to the FCC. All right, federal regulation. We His Royal Highness could get mad at us. All right, let's take a quick time out, and we'll be back with Chuck Swirsky. It's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 of the Score.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.